Let's move on. Let's move back across the ocean to UK and UK alternative, which is a very loose category here. There's a couple of sacred cows I think we're going to be slaughtering in this category. But let's start off with a positive, a debut album.
Yeah, yeah.
Felt Mountain by Goldfrapp. We love this record, don't we?
I adore it.
We both love this record. It's funny because in her catalogue, she never really revisited this approach, did she?
No.
I say she, it's actually Goldfrapp duo. Even though Alison Goldfrapp is the singer, it's Alison Goldfrapp and the Nerd and the Bird configuration. Alison Goldfrapp and Will Gregory, the kind of arranged musician.
This is the moment when Stephen Wilson was cancelled, obviously.
Well, because I've said the Nerd and the Bird. Yeah. It's a well-known enough expression, is it not? Nerd and the Bird, you know. This album has such a strong influence, doesn't it, from things that I know you love and you grew up with I also love it, which is the kind of John Barry Bond theme. The influence from cinema is palpable, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right through this whole record. I mean, yes, I think you can hear it's very much a post-trip hop kind of album. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's going back to things like John Barry, Bond themes, Shirley Bassey, the musical language of the 60s soundtrack, isn't it?
Well, again, like Broadcast, it's one of those things where it's gone right back to the 60s. But what a 2000 sounding album it is. The technology, the filtering of the voice, the rhythms. So it really is this kind of retro futurist. And yeah, the obvious precedent is Portishead's debut album, which also drew from John Barry and that kind of vocabulary. But this does it maybe in a much more sensual way.
This is not this is not lo-fi. The Portishead thing, I think, was almost making it lo-fi. This is very cinematic and hi-fi, isn't it? It's got all the production sort of values of, you know, a very expensively recorded album, whereas Portishead almost were deliberately looking for to make things sound lo-fi, dirty, rusty. None of that here, is there?
Well, every track, almost, apart from some of the instrumentals and the umpar pieces, because they bring umpar back, which is
umpar,
kind of interesting.
Title, that.
But for me, it's almost like the best Bond soundtrack of all time for about eight of the tracks. It's like you're completely lost in that world. And she's got a fantastic voice.
Hasn't she?
And I guess the thing is, she does Shirley Bassey, but with the elements that you don't like taken off. So she's got the power, she's got the drama, but she's not over dramatic.
So let's move, that moves us perfectly on to Anthony and the Johnsons.
Yeah.
Another critic's darling. This is the first album from Anthony. We talk about debut albums. This is the debut album for Anthony and the Johnsons, who I think I'm right in saying is also essentially an individual, despite the name, right?
Yeah, I think there might be a band with
overachieving voices that put me off because they're so overdramatic, overreaching, and I just get to the point where I just find it off-putting and hysterical. This is one of those voices. I know she has got an extraordinary talent, an extraordinary voice, and she is tapping into the kind of Judy Garland music hall tradition. I think there's a lot of that sort of vaudeville in the I don't like that. I've never liked musicals. I've never...
Interesting. That's exactly my... You know. Yeah. So, yeah, Anoni. I think, amazing.
Anoni, is that how you say the voice?
I think,
But it was Anthony and the Johnsons at this
point. Anoni and the Johnsons. Brilliant voice, distinctive voice. In this case, I can understand why the critics get excited. And the arrangements are superb on this album. But the voice isn't, for me, as amazing as I think that voice is. It's far too Broadway, West End, incredibly dramatic. Sometimes you like it, sometimes you don't. And as gifted as Anoni is, it just doesn't speak to me.
Do you think this might be a more common feeling than we think? Because she's not been that successful, has she, in terms of commercial mainstream? And yet she's got all the talent.
Yeah.
But as far as I know, apart from being a critic's darling, she's never really crossed over to a bigger market.
It's possible. I mean, you know, I do know people who absolutely adore the voice.
As do I.
So it's difficult to say because if you don't get something, and sometimes, you know, we know this, it's kind of...
It's a Marmite voice. I guess what I'm saying is this a Marmite? I hope the listeners know what I mean when I say
Marmite.
But then
some Marmite
voices,
as we said before, you know, the Marmite or Vegemite for Australians here... you know, a great example of that, well, two that have been huge. Brian Ferry and Morrissey, you know, you cannot get two more Marmite, Vegemite voices. Yet, it's not got in the way of their success.
They both were willing to play being the pop star, though. I got the feeling that she's not prepared to be.
Right.
You know, maybe she just doesn't want that kind of success. Maybe she could have had it if she'd sort of, you know, wanted to play that role.
Well, this is it. Is it in the voice, the material, or the wanting to play the pop star? It's kind of difficult to know, isn't it, sometimes?
I think sometimes it has to be the whole package. Otherwise, you know, it doesn't cross over.
So it's a really good, you know, really good debut. And it's,
I agree,
it's worth what the critics say about it. You know, this time round, when it's the Mojo album of the year, I'm not complaining. I can see exactly what they're getting. But yeah, for
you're not complaining
reason,
like when they make Ryan. You are complaining when they make Ryan Adams.
Ryan Adams. I'm hitting the wall. I'm taking a hammer to the wall.
For goodness sake. Yeah. It's the 21st century here we're talking about.
Exactly.
Just about.
When Elliot Smith is the Mojo album of the year, my head is hitting that wall.
Yeah. Well, especially when you've got, you know, to be fair, I think everyone made Kid A the album of the year this year, as far as I can tell, anyway.
And with that, I'm all right.
I'm all right with that too.
Fair dues, Sam.
Right, while we're in the groove here, Tim, of slaughtering the sacred cows. PJ Harvey. I don't get it.
I get it more.
PJ, how many times has she been nominated for the Mercury Music Prize? 47 times now?
200.
247 times. How many times has her album been made album of the year by the critics?
Every year.
Every year. Even if she hasn't released an album.
It's an album of the year.
PJ Harvey will still get album of the year, even if she hasn't released anything. I don't get it. Well, it just sounds... I mean, I'm not saying she's bad at all.
She's good. It is good.
It's not that interesting, is it?
I'm not kidding. I don't dislike it. I think there's some pretty decent, you know, the last couple of tracks are good. There's some good material. I've bought this album a couple of times. I've tried to love it. And interestingly, I compare it with another album that came out this year, which was the Patti Smith album, because I love Patti Smith. And this year's Patti Smith album, it suffers from being overlong. You know, quite a number of albums this year, because it's the heyday of the CD age album, where I've got 18 minutes, I'm going to use it. You know, I'm going to have a 65-minute album, a 70-minute album. Mm. No, Patti, this is a great album, but if it was 40 minutes, it'd be one of your best albums of all time. Mm. You know, in that album, which is all really good, she's got a 40-minute all-time classic. To me, it's just an odd thing that when I listen to the Patti Smith album, then listen to PJ Harvey, which is the closest comparison in this year, the Patti Smith album, her voice really gets a hold of me, tears me apart. I love the Patti Smith album. Also, even sonically, the Patti Smith album is sort of pushing the envelope. You know, she's quite an old artist at this point, but she's doing some quite intimate things. But then she's also really driving the drums up in a way that's suggesting, you know, she's listening to what's happening out there. So I don't know. I can't say anything particularly bad about the PJ Harvey album.
Me neither.
Because I think it's good.
Yeah.
But I can't get excited about it.
No, I think that's the problem I have. I sometimes, you know, I sometimes feel like there's something I'm not getting.
Yeah.
With PJ Harvey. A bit like we talked about, you know, with, you know, the Springsteens, the Dylans. Something obviously I'm not getting, because so many people tell me it's genius. I've never particularly, I mean, I've bought a few albums over the years, a bit like you. I bought one called White Chalk, I think, which is more of a stripped down piano voice. And I just thought, this is something that I think other artists would have done better, is the wrong word, just more to my taste, perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that is it.
Bjork released Selma Songs, which is the soundtrack to the Dancer in the Dark movie. It's a good record, isn't it?
Yeah, very beautiful.
Yorkie Boy's on that one too.
He's on everything this year.
Let's talk about the Primal Scream album, Exterminator, because what I love about Primal... Now, we talked about overachieving voices.
Yeah.
Bobby Gillespie's got, a bit like me... He's got an underachieving voice.
You're being falsely modest.
No, I'm not.
You've got a good voice.
Have I? Well, it's very nice.
You've got a good voice, and you really stretched it on the latest album.
I always feel very limited by what I can and cannot do with my voice. And it's never stopped Bobby Gillespie. Good on him. And I like Primal Scream, but I almost like the idea of them more than I like the reality sometimes. One of the things I love about Primal Scream is every album, it's like, oh, we've done that, let's do something different. So you've got Screamadelica, which is kind of their Acid House Summer of Love album. Followed it with the Rolling Stones Pastiche album, which I didn't like. It wasn't my kind of thing.
Yeah.
Whatever it was called, Get With It and Get Out of It, or whatever it was called. And then a couple of albums later, they're making this album, Exterminator, which is almost like they've got Kevin Shields from My Bloody Valentine. It's a noise album, isn't it? It's like
Tommy York on it.
Yorkie Boy, he's not on this one. Okay. But it's almost like the Chemical Brothers with added noise, isn't it? It's got the kind of big beat, breakbeat thing, but there's a lot of noise and it's almost like fuzz has been applied to everything in the mix.
Yeah.
And it's quite interesting and it's quite...
Manny's on it as well. He's a bass player from Stone Roses.
It's exciting. It's a real rush to listen to it. Yeah. I don't think there are any songs there. I don't think Primal Scream was ever really about songs, but in a production sense, in a kind of reinventing their sound way.
No, it's really totally fresh, agree. I mean, like you know, they've never been an all-time favourite, but they will occasionally come up with something really special. And I think what's good is that Bobby Gillespie, as you say, one, he reinvents himself, but two, he surrounds himself with the right people for each project. Mm. And this one, it sounds great. You know, it's really driven. And as you said, everything is kind of hypercharged. The drums, the bass, the grooves are fantastic. So it's their sort of noise groove rock album. And they pulled off really well.
Let's move on, Tim. I think we can move very swiftly through these next couple of categories because this is out of our comfort zone, okay? But we're going to give them a name check anyway because we like to at least mention these albums.
It's covering the year.
There's some big records. There's some big records here. I just don't know them. Yeah. Metal and US rock. Okay. Brave New World by Iron Maiden.
Pretty good album. That was the return of Bruce Dickinson, and Maiden were in epic form. And actually, from this point onwards, their albums get more conceptual, more ambitious. And I quite like the fact that they still seem to be enjoying making music and finding themselves in a slightly different place.
Because we know that Steve Harris and Bruce always loved a bit of prog anyway. Oh, yeah. They like a big concept, you know.
And you can hear it on this because Brave New World, it's the
Aldous Huxley. Yeah, I'm guessing, yeah.
And from this point onwards, I think the success of it led them to get even more ambitious. You know, they're later in Matter of Life and Death, some of the albums that follow this. If you like Iron Maiden, they're still on really good form.
I do like Iron Maiden.
And still enjoying it. I mean, weirdly enough, despite that, I think they're making some of the best music now. My favourite Iron Maiden album is still the first.
Me too. I love the Deano records, the first two Deano records, because I love the sort of more punky, new wave British heavy metal sound. I think, obviously, they became a much more impressive, quote-unquote, band, much more sophisticated band later on. But yeah, I'll always have a soft spot for those things. Sun-O. OO Void. Now, I think it's fair to say, we were talking about earlier about Gas, how Gas have the one gag, or that Godspeed You Black Emperor have the one gag.
Yeah.
So they've got one gag, haven't they? And their gag is, let's take, from an old Black Sabbath album, let's take the drums and the vocals out of the mix, let's isolate the guitar and the bass, and then let's slow it down to a tenth of its original speed.
Exactly that.
That is the Sun-O. And so they have been innovators, they kind of were copying what a band called Earth, an American band called Earth, had started doing a few years earlier, but they've really honed in on it and refined it. This idea of drone metal or ambient metal. It's a great gag, isn't it?
It works really well. And yeah, I think ambient metal probably is the best description because in a way it's sort of comforting and beautiful, yet it's pure noise and pure metal. Mm. And obviously there have been deviations because they made an album with Scott Walker in about 2012, was it? Which is actually really good. I mean, what is quite surprising about that one is you're getting this avant-garde ambient metal band, Scott Walker, who at that point was really taking himself into some strange places. And oddly, that album's quite listenable. It's actually one of the more accessible albums both of them have put together. And Walker's on great voice throughout it. Really good. I like Sun-O.
I've got almost every Sun-O album they've ever made. And I do sometimes ask myself why.
Yeah.
Because they do have the... It basically becomes, what other musical elements can we add to this? So there'll be albums where they've added a church organ, or there'll be albums where they've added a monologue or something like that. It's a great gag. It's a great gag, and actually almost any Sun-O album would do. This one is more about just the sound of the guitars. Mm. Later albums are a bit more opening things up a little bit more in terms of the musical forces. But great gag, yes. Let's talk about this album, Tim, because I felt like we should talk. This is the last album in the category, and I felt like we should stop on this one a little bit because it's one of the biggest selling albums of all time. It's almost like you can't just, you know, gloss over it. I'd never listened to it. Okay. I'm clearly not the age or the demographic to have heard it before. I did listen to it in preparation for this podcast, and I've got my one sentence review of it, which I'll give you in a minute.
Okay.
Linkin Park's Hybrid Theory is one of the best-selling albums of all time. It sold like about a billion copies, apparently, or maybe a few trillion, I don't know. Here's my one sentence review of this album. See if you take issue with this, okay? Bit of Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah.
Bit of hip hop.
Mm-hmm.
Bit of new metal. Package it like a boy band.
What a recipe for success that was.
It was massive.
Yeah.
What do you think of my one sentence summing up?
I think you're pretty much there. I think they're kind of better. You know, I remember the singles as they came out. Like you, I only listened to the album for this, but I remembered the singles. And they had a sound and they pulled it off. I mean, basically, it was almost like a kind of, almost a boy band sweetness in the voices. And then they'd go into a kind of a death metal chorus. And they did it really well. They did it with aplomb, I think is the word.
Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying it's bad.
So the production is great and the shifts of tone, they pull off brilliantly. It's not my kind of music. I mean, I do really like Nine Inch Nails. And I think, you know, it's unfortunately, it's a reference lost on you, but it's the sort of music that I do think baby Colin Robinson would have liked when he was going through his teen rebellion phase.
Okay, I hope the listeners understand what that means.
What We Do in the Shadows, sitcom with Matt Berry.
I know of Matt Berry. I love Matt Berry.
And baby Colin Robinson goes through...
Matt Berry's just texted me. He just texted me to say...
Say that I'm talking bollocks.
No, he's just texted me to say, I've just... This is happening as we speak, guys.
Yeah.
I've just played the Imagine white piano last week. Never thought I'd type that. Okay, just fresh news in from Matt Berry there. I hope he won't mind you sharing that with me.
Anyway, I've played the Mrs. Mills piano, Abbey Road.
I've played Benny's piano at Polar Studios before Polar Studios was destroyed. That he played Dancing Queen on.
Yeah, yeah.
That's all I'll say. I think that trumps. I think that trumps everything, including the John Lennon piano, in my opinion.
What, including the Mrs. Mills piano?
Including the Mrs. Mills. I'm sorry.
What, the day in
Benny's
the life?
Benny's piano from Dancing Queen. It just trumps them all.
Oh, all right.
If you ask me.
So, yeah, no, it's really well done, and I can see why it was successful, because there's a kind of... They pull off the sweetness and the gruffness, and it sounds fantastic.
Okay, let's move on to another album in the same... that I feel the same way about. This is the US rap category now.
Okay.
Have you heard them US rappers? Have you heard them rappers? Do you know about them rappers over in the US? They're like rappers.
Okay.
Going to Stuart Lee.
You mean Grandmaster Flash, that kind
of thing. Those kind of rappers. Have you heard them rappers? They're all over the place, them rappers.
I've heard Gil Scott-Heron,
The young kids, they like them rappers. Have you heard
the
them
last
rappers?
Poets, I've heard them.
Yeah, you like them.
I like them.
Right. Okay. So even bigger than the Linkin Park album.
Yeah.
The other people in the room probably will know this record. Rob and Miles Scarron are both here listening to us thinking, what are these two old fuckers talking about? Right. Even bigger than the Linkin Park record, Eminem, Marshall Mathers LP.
Yeah.
So I listened to it. It's so. Whereas the Linkin Park album sold about 3 trillion, the Eminem album has sold about 25 gazillion, apparently. I listened to it. To me, it sounded like a white boy adopting all the tropes and style of black gangster rappers. That's what it sounded like to me. I might be doing him a disservice. He might have grown up exactly in the same way, but that's what it sounded like to me. And to me, that says, this is why white people bought it when they wouldn't have bought the Public Enemy and they wouldn't have bought the NWA album. But they will buy the Eminem album, which is why it's sold 27 gazillion records. Now, I may be being really unfair there. It might be a lot better than that. This music, I don't understand it because I'm an old man. Lots of stuff about hoes and bitches and popping caps and stuff, which can just about get along with the Public Enemy record.
Everyday life in Basingstoke.
Everyday life in Boxmoor, Hemel Hempstead. Yeah. I can just... I'm going to sound like a 300 years old. Oh, for fuck's sake. Rob and Miles, did you like Eminem's The Marshall Mathers LP when you were growing up?
It was sort of everywhere.
It was ubiquitous, wasn't it? Yeah. That song Stan.
Yeah.
That song Stan is on this record, isn't it?
I think the point is he had pop star presence and his voice was distinctive in that field. And while I take your point that it's kind of white boy doing black music, he did it well and he had a presence. It was, again, not for me, but it was ubiquitous. I remember it being around. And, you know, he had interesting use of samples occasionally as well. So again, you know, never going to be my music, but I could sort of see the quality.
But it's an interesting use of samples. I mean, you could apply that to almost any American hip-hop record.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, the other two records on the list, which I liked more, Outkast, Stankonia, and Wu-Tang Clan's The W. To me, again, really interesting use of sampling and beats. The next category we've got here is progressive rock.
Yeah.
And the first, I think it's fair to say it's not a great year for progressive rock, except obviously Porcupine Tree's Lightbulb Sun came out. Mm-hmm. But apart from that, not a great year for progressive rock. Ovo, Peter Gabriel is the first one. So I don't know much about this album, Tim. It was kind of like a soundtrack to his Millennium Dome show.
It was a soundtrack for the Millennium Dome. And
he doesn't sing on it himself, or he does?
He does sing on some, yeah. Okay. You know, Father Son, which is arguably the best track on it, he sings, and it's a really beautiful piano miniature. I mean, the thing is, for me, it's quite like a lot of Gabriel albums since So, that all of them could be shorter. There are three or four of the best things he's ever done. And I really count I.O. in this as well. That I.O., I think there are three or four tracks that are the best things amongst the best things he's ever done. You're doing that best of Peter Gabriel, they're on it. But there are quite a number of tracks that wouldn't get anywhere close to that. And also it's a little overlong, you know, it's 65 minutes or what have you. And it's not honing what's good. So his voice is amazing. He's still as capable of writing songs that are as affecting as ever. He did two versions of it. One version, which is the special edition, doesn't have the Ovo rap. It has it as a on a second disc.
So what is the Ovo rap then? Is it him rapping?
Opens it. No, he uses Naina Cherry and a rapper. And it's kind of Peter Gabriel music. So he won't do it himself. I mean, on the album, he sings a few, but he gets great singers. I mean, Richie Havens sings on it. And Richie Havens, I've got to say this, I think Richie Havens, when Gabriel left Genesis, that's your replacement. If Richie Havens had joined...
Well, he's on Steve Hackett's...
And he's on Steve Hackett's
first post-Genesis solo.
I mean, what an amazing voice.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
I think Phil Collins is brilliant. You know, obviously, Phil Collins' voice is stunning. But he'd have been such a
if
natural
Phil hadn't
replacement.
Been there, yeah, yeah.
And an amazing voice. And again, you can see this, that Gabriel's clearly a fan, brings Havens. Yeah. Havens is stunning. It's got early performances. This is interesting. Alison Goldfrapp's on it. She's one of the female vocalists. Okay. Will Gregory from Goldfrapp also does some of the arrangements. Alison Goldfrapp doesn't get credited on the album, though, still.
Oh.
It's odd. Really? She's not on the credits, but she sings. Liz Fraser sings. Paul Buchanan. So it's a list of some of my favourite vocalists of all time. And for me, you know, I guess it's in the nature of it being a
and
soundtrack.
And his too, clearly. I mean, that's why he's invited them. They're all his favourite singer.
Yeah, and they're brilliant. And there's a few tracks that are, you know, great. Downside Up, Make Tomorrow, Father Son. So again, it's like if I'm putting together that greatest Peter Gabriel album, it's going to have a few things from this. It's going to have a few things from Up, a few things from I.O. But maybe as a whole, perhaps it betrays the fact that it's a soundtrack album too often.